me make sure this is on. Okay, now it's doing something. Yeah. Okay. Right. Various kinds of paper, which I'm sure you're all eagerly awaiting. Graded homework. And new homework sheets. As I said, there is this homework, and then there will be one on the Monday after the fall break, and that will be the homework. And that on the Monday after the fall break is then due the last week. Right? We have 2 weeks after the Thanksgiving break. Okay. Right. Yeah. Are there questions? And I will talk about the exam in a moment more, just in case there are questions about the homework or something. No? Okay. Then let me talk a little bit about the midterm problems.
Did you say there aren't questions about the homework?
Yeah, if there are questions about...
I did have one about the bonus one. I'm not sure that I...
Yes.
So you push one button on the typewriter and it types a different button?
Yes, basically. Okay. I mean, it doesn't type. It has a light glow up, but that's what it does.
Okay.
Okay. And the mechanism they used is that actually now, if you just do this kind of swapping the letters, that is very easy to break as a code because you can look at letter frequencies. You know that E is the letter used most frequently in German or English, and you can deduce from this, the most frequent letter is likely E, and then you can guess T and R and so forth, and you can break it. So what the mechanism did in addition is that the permutation done to the letters with every letter was different. The permutation done to the first letter was different to the permutation done to the second letter and so forth. To basically scramble, over the words that you couldn't just do these counting statistics. But as far as the problem is concerned, this is completely irrelevant. So what the machine does, if you consider the letters as numbers 1 to 26, the machine produces the permutations of the points 1 to 26. Okay. And the first part is just the easy observation that not every permutation is equal to its own inverse. Well, if it has order 2, it is. Otherwise, it is not. And if you ever had to deal with the military, you might realize that this is an organization which does not thrive on initiative, or at least the way I experience it, it does not thrive on initiative or individual thinking. What they love is to write down fixed rules which someone has to follow. And so they probably wouldn't even have wanted the person operating the machine to read what they were decrypting or encrypting, but just to do it letter by letter. Okay. Now, if you have that decryption and encryption are different ways, you would need two different machines or an extra setting on the machine or so. And they felt this is too complicated. Our operators will not be able to do this, or we will not be able to train them on this. We want it more simple. Okay. And the idea they had is basically that they said, okay, what we do is instead of just taking this permutation P, we take furthermore what is called the plug board. We also apply then the permutation B from the plug board and then apply P inverse again. And this P inverse came by using this permutation is produced by some mechanical by a mechanism, basically cables going around mixed up. And what you just do is you have, instead of just going through these mixed up cables here and going out, you have the plug board here, you go back in and you go to another contact and you go through the other mixed cables and come out back here. Okay. And what they thought is, okay, since they even could change this here, they had other permutations. It looked as if they have even more ways of mixing it up, as if it was even a better mixing. And they have this mechanism that this produces a permutation which has order 2. So basically, P is a random permutation, a random element of the symmetric group on 26 letters, and B is a permutation which, by relabeling the letters without loss of generality, you can basically assume it's of the form 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so forth, up to 25, 26. Okay, and if you then form this, you will see this has order 2, therefore this has also order 2. So this encrypts and decrypts in the same way. But if you calculate the number of possibilities which you can get, you can also see that if I write this down in cycle form, I get exactly the same cycle form. I will get 13 two cycles here. But if you now count, how many permutations do you have for P? You have 26 factorial permutations for P. How many permutations of this cycle form do you have? You have, basically, you can choose the image for one, there you have 25 possibilities, then you can choose the image for the next smallest point, where you have 23 possibilities, and so forth. And that product is much, much smaller than 26 factorial. It's about the square root of 26 factorial, very roughly. So what has happened by this clever trick is that this number of permutations which this machine produced, which you really want to be big because you want to scramble, you want to make it hard for someone to decrypt it, that they reduce the number of scramblings enormously to about the square root. And so they had much fewer scramblings in practice. And that was actually part of what helped to break this encryption machine. The reason the problem is there is basically just, I think it's an interesting story that it happened, that actually some basic algebra, or knowing some basic algebra would have helped in designing something better to decrypt her. So it's here in the course, essentially it's just a problem on permutations, on just checking again, okay, what is the order of, if I have this permutation, what is the order or what is the form of such a permutation? But it's not really relevant for anything further in the course. Other questions? No? Okay, then let me talk a bit about the problems in the midterm. So the first problem was basically about, we have as a ring, we have the polynomials in two variables, x and y, and we take an ideal in there, the ideal generated by y. And the question was, show that this is a prime ideal, but not a maximal ideal. Okay, first remark, prime ideal is something similar, different than principal ideal. It is a principal ideal, but they are two different terms. They start both with P, but please don't get confused between these two. Okay. To show that it is a prime ideal, we basically have two choices. We can either use the definition, or we can use a property which follows from it. And we know two properties which are related to it. One which is specific to integers or rings of polynomials, where we can say if a polynomial does not have factors, we happen to know that the ideal generated by this polynomial will be a prime ideal. That works, but that really just works for ideals generated by one element. Remember it, but don't rely on this as a fact. It is quite possible that if I put such a problem again on the exam, I will put an ideal on which is generated by two elements, and then you cannot use the irreducibility criterion. So, you could have used, and many of you did, that Y is irreducible, and therefore this ideal must be a prime ideal. But in general, the way for the definition would be to show that is to show that if a product of two polynomials lies in there, what would this mean? So you have two polynomials A and B, and their product is a multiple of Y, then one of the factors has to be in there. And essentially the reason that one of the factors has to be in there, that you can't create new variables by polynomial multiplication. Or that the factorization into irreducible polynomials is unique. The much slicker way, and that was the one I was hoping for, is to refer to the quotient ring. We know an ideal is a prime ideal if and only if the quotient ring is an integral domain. And I told you in the problem, the quotient ring is the polynomial ring in one variable over the rationals. We know that is an integral domain. We don't have zero divisors. If I multiply two non-zero rational polynomials, the product can't be zero. Unless both polynomials are the zero polynomial. So the quotient ring is an integral domain. So therefore the ideal is a prime ideal. To show that it is not a maximal ideal, again, we can either refer to the quotient ring. We know that an ideal is a maximal ideal if and only if the quotient ring is a field. Well, the polynomial ring in one variable is not a field. X does not have an inverse. So this ideal is not a maximal ideal. Or we can use the definition and give a bigger proper ideal. So bigger ideal, this bigger ideal can't be the whole ring. I need to show that this bigger ideal still is not the whole ring. And basically what I know in the quotient ring, that X is not an inverse in the quotient ring, would help me finding a larger ideal, namely if you take the ideal generated by X and Y, this would be a strictly larger ideal. But this, which is strictly larger, but this again is not the whole ring, because the constant, these are just polynomials which have X and Y terms. These polynomials have no constant terms. So that would be, either of these two ways would be ways for proving this. A couple of you wrote as bigger ideal the ideal generated by Y square. That is not bigger, that is smaller, right? If you take the ideal generated by Y, it's all the multiples of Y. The ideal generated by Y square is certainly a multiple of Y, so it lies in there. And the multiples of y, every multiple of y square is also a multiple of y. So that's why the multiples of y square lie in there, why they are something smaller. To get something bigger, yes, if we had the square root of y, we could have taken this, but we don't have a square root of y. So we can't just do this. So that's why we basically need to add some other element there to make it bigger. Okay, and please feel free to interrupt if there are further questions or so about this. The next problem was similar but not exactly the same as I did last week Monday in class. A couple of you unfortunately solved the problem which we did in class. So please read through the problems correctly what they do. But it was a problem which we had before on the homework. Basically, in class, in the homework, we did two parts, and then we did one thing last week on Monday. So, namely, showing that if I take the pre-image of an ideal, all the elements which are mapped into an ideal, that this gives me an ideal. In the exam, was the other direction, that the image of an ideal is an ideal. And what one needs to do there is basically to say, to use the properties for an ideal and to refer, to translate them, the properties for B to properties of A where we know that it is an ideal. So basically the core of the proof will look something like this. Let X and Y be elements in B. Then by the definition of B, we know there must exist elements A and, well, let's call it C, just so I don't confuse the letters, in A, such that X is the image of A, and Y is the image of C. Okay, And now I can take x plus y. What is this? This is phi of a plus phi of c. And that, by the properties of homomorphism, is phi of a plus c. And a plus c, I know, lies in a because a is an ideal. So therefore, this lies in b. And then something similar for multiplication. So you need to pick elements in there and then to say, yes, they are images of elements there. If you don't have a good idea how to do these things, just draw yourself a small sketch. Draw your rings, your ring R, your ring S. You have the set A in here. This is mapped by phi to some set B. And now you have elements in here. And that might help you to say, okay, what can you tell about elements here? Well, they must be images of elements here. It also helps you to see where your objects come from, what sets they come from. Okay, that's problem two. Problem three was about permutation multiplication and then calculating the order of two permutations. Quite a few just did the permutation multiplication, and therefore I've given almost all credit just for the permutation multiplication and just 2 points for the orders. I mean, the order is easy. It's just the least common multiple of the length of all the cycles. Problem four was about testing whether subsets are subgroups. And the easiest way of doing this is to do the subgroup test as we've done it before the exams in a couple of lectures and quite a few examples. Show that the product of two elements that is not empty, show that the product of two elements is in there and that for every element the inverse is in there. So the first was given by elements, so there, yes, there one needed to do a couple of permutation multiplications, but I hope they were small enough that it wasn't really a burden to do these. The last problem was also a subgroup test, but one which was a little bit more complicated, I thought. Again, this was similar to something which we had done in class, but basically in class we had the centralizer of one element, we choose an element G in G, and we say the centralizer in G of this element is the set of all X in G such that XG is equal to GX. In the exam, I had basically that G was not specified, but that I want that it holds for all G in G. So we had the center of G, that's the set of all elements X in G, such that xg is equal to gx for all g in g. Okay. And in some way, what you need to do is, again, just the subgroup test stubbornly through, show that it's not empty by showing that the identity element is in there, show that the product of two elements lies in there, and that the inverse lies in there. And how do we show that something lies in there? By showing that it fulfills this defining property. So, for example, how do we do the product? So we pick, a lot of you with products took product x times g or something like this. X times g does not lie in this set in there. It's just part of the property which defines this set. But x times g does not lie in there. So what do we do to show that it's closed under multiplication? We pick two elements in the set and write down what these elements are. And this is not just because I want to be, not because I want to be picky in how you write it down. This will help you writing these things down, even though it's a few letters that to write, will help you in solving the problem. So what do we show? So to show that it's closed under products. We pick two elements in the set, and that's always the same. So let two elements, okay, the elements in the set here were called X, so X and Y are reasonable numbers for these elements. You could even, I mean, I would be careful with calling them G because G is already used in this defining property, and then it's very easy to get confused with it. You could call them A and B if you wanted, but let's call them X and Y be elements in this set. Okay. And what do we have to show? We don't formally need to write this down for the proof, but it is often convenient to have this there just to remind us what we have to do. So we have to show that X times Y is in this set. Okay. And so far, this is almost, apart from how we call this set, the same for any kind of subgroup or subring tests or so. Right. Now, we need to use the concrete set and we need to use this defining property. We first need to use it here to actually get some conclusion from the fact that X and Y are not arbitrary group elements, but elements in this set. Clearly, we have to use this at some point. So we know that XG is equal to GX and YG is equal to GY for all G in G. And what do we have to show? We have to show that XYG is equal to GXY for all G in G. So that's where we want to end up with. Okay. And now, so far we haven't really started thinking even. We've just written down the basic, just the assumption we have two elements, so we just remember we want to show product is in there, and we've basically copied the defining property. Okay, and now I want to show this. So let's start with one side here, because if I want to show this equality at some point, I probably need to end up with this side. So let's look at XYG. Right. Now I can recognize in there YG, where I know that YG is GY, so this is XGY. I recognize an XG in there, which I know is GX. And hooray, I am there with the right-hand side, which I want. So I now just need to observe. So X times Y fulfills the defining property for this set. That's what I had to show. So X times Y lies in this set. And with X inverse, it's a little bit more tricky because I basically need to multiply with X inverse from two sides. We had something similar in when we did it for the centralizer. So I don't want to repeat this here. Surprisingly, more of you had the inverse part correct than actually the product part, which surprised me a little bit. Okay. So that's basically what I wanted to say about the exam problems. But if there are other questions or about the exam or about the homework or so, please don't be shy asking. Yeah?
What was the average?
Somewhere in the 60s. I don't remember exactly. Somewhere in the 60s.
You said it was at 80,
not 100? Yes. Yeah? No? Sorry?
63.
Okay, so this is to show that there is, for every natural number, there is a group with n, there is a group with n elements. Okay. Well, if you don't know it in general, just pick some concrete numbers. Do you know a group with five elements? Did we have an example of this? Well, if you take the integers modulo 5, you have five elements, right? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. If you want now a group with six elements, does this give you a hint how to make a group with six elements? Well, presumably integers modulo 6 and so forth. That gives you a group with n elements for each n. The second part is, well, there basically you need to look, what I would do there is look at the examples of groups we had, presumably small groups because it's easier to deal with them, and just we knew how what their order were. We knew how many elements these groups had in some cases. And just check were these groups of the class which you specified in part A, right? So we had, for example, the symmetries of a triangle. There were six symmetries, so this was a group of order six. Is this the same group as multiplication modulo, integer addition modulo six? It's unlikely to be. For example, one is abelian, the other is non-abelian. So they're very clearly different groups. Okay? Yeah? Oh, then 68 is, that shouldn't have gone in there again. Sorry, this is a, sorry, yeah, then 68 is basically just deleted. Yeah. I'm copying this from older ones in there. It accidentally slipped through twice. Other questions? No? Okay. So, what we did last time is we looked at a subgroup generated by elements. What was this subgroup? This consisted of, if I have certain elements, I take all the products of these elements and their inverses in all possible ways, and that, we have seen, gives us a subgroup. And we had even seen how we could get the elements of the subgroup, though in general, if the number of elements gets bigger, this is not necessarily something which you wanted to do by hand. On the other hand, it is something which a computer can do reasonably easily, and therefore I now want to look at some examples on the computer, simply to save us the work of doing lots of multiplications of group elements. And in particular, the one thing in there, I probably don't even need to show this because it's printed out here in all gory or more gory detail than you want. This is just an example in GAP where I take a group generated by two permutations and I ask it, what are the elements of this group? And indeed, it will very quickly give me a list of the elements, and it uses exactly the same method as I've shown you last time, respectively, what is written on this sheet. But what I want to do today is actually use this fact for something, well, semi-applicable. Namely, if I have a group generated by elements, this means every element of that subgroup can be written as a product of generators or generators in their inverses. Every element is such a product. And finding out how to write it as a product actually is useful for solving certain types of problems. And there is a command built into GAP, which is called factorization, which does exactly this. So it takes a group, it takes an which is generated by elements, it takes an element of this group, and it tells you how this element can be written as a product of generators. Okay. Let me turn, oh, this is not yet on. Let me turn this on. And I want to go here. Oh, where am I? Too far. Okay. And what this does internally is basically the same as what we did in an example last time. when I enumerated all the elements, the only thing what it does is it doesn't just enumerate the elements, it remembers how it got them as a product. It's, and you clearly can remember it because everything is obtained as a product. You just remember how every element was obtained. If an element so far was obtained was the product A times B square, the next element you get, you obtain by multiplying it with A again, you know that the product has to be AB square A. Let's see whether it does something. Yes, it does. Okay. Very good. So, for example, I had this group here. In the example, I have two permutations, A1, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. A2 is the permutation which swaps 1, 2, and 3, 4. And they are basically picked almost random. I make the group by these permutations of A1 and A2. Okay. And if I now ask, say, for this factorization in this group of the element 1, 5, 3, 4, say, it tells me this. It's the inverse of the first element squared times the second element times the first element squared. So if I try this out, I have inverse squared times A2 times A1 squared. If I multiply this out, indeed I get the same element. So it just tells me how to write this element as such a product. Okay. A priori that might just look like a curiosity, but now let me show you some cases where this is actually relevant, where it does something useful. And the first example I want to look at is an example. Let's say you had to sort elements. Okay, and this is a toy example, so I just have very few elements, but you can easily construct some where it is bigger. So let's suppose you have the letters E, D, B, C, A, and you want, well, this is just in reverse, you want to bring them in order. Okay, obviously, you know, well, you can just say, oh, it's A, B, C, D, E, but now let's assume these are not letters, let's assume these are big boxes which you want to order. And the only thing which you can do is that you can swap two adjacent boxes. You can't really place them somewhere new because they're heavy and you don't have space and so forth. So how can I order this? By swapping adjacent elements. Well, the first question might come, can I actually always do it? And we will see in a little while that one can. But for the moment, let's assume we can. How can we do this? Well, I choose permutations, namely, I say, well, let's first say, what permutation is this actually? I want to perform the permutation. I want to swap, if this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I want to swap the elements in position 1 and 5, right? And the element in position 2, I want to move into position 4 because that's where B should go. The element in position 4, I want to move into position 3. The element in position 3, I want to move into position 2. So that permutation is what I want to perform on the letters, right? If I perform that, they will be in order. Okay? Or, again, if there are questions, yeah? Yeah, that's not yet adjacent, but that's the permutation I want to do in total. That's what I'm looking for. Now I give you the permutations of adjacent letters. Namely, I have A1 is swapping 1 and 2, A2 is swapping 2 and 3, A3 is swapping 3 and 4, and A4 is swapping 4 and 5. Okay. And now I make the group generated by these permutations. So I take 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5. Okay. And now I ask, what I want to do is I want to express in this group this permutation as a product of the of these generators, right? Okay, and what it tells me is the product or a product is this. What I should say is this product form is not, even if I want it of shortest length, it's not always unique. So what this will return you is a product of shortest length, but someone else might come up with a different one if they wanted to. Okay, so now how can I, how do I have this, have to read this? So the Xi's now correspond to these four generators with the same numbers, right? So what is this telling me? This is telling me, yeah, now I should have brought, well, I have a couple of things. A, B, well, they don't have letters. Oh, no, that doesn't work. Should have brought some letter blocks with me. How do I swap them? Okay, it first says X1, so I swap these, I apply this permutation, I swap these two, right? So I end up with D, E, B, C, A. Now I apply X2, I swap these two, so I end up with D, B, E, C, A. X3, swapping these two, D, B, C, E, A. X4, swapping these two, D, B, C, A, E. Okay. So far, this seemed to, this is easy. We bring just E over there. Okay. Now next, I have again X1, so I swap B and D. Next, I have X2, I swap C and D. And now I do X3, X2, X1, X3 swaps A and D, X2 swaps A and C, X1 swaps A and B. And I have brought it into order by just doing swaps of adjacent letters. Okay. This is still not that particularly hard a problem. If you just try it out, you probably quickly come up with a scheme here. Basically, you just would need to do swaps of adjacent letters and just avoid that you move something too far. But there is one class of problems, namely puzzle type problems, where it is not always immediately clear how to do this. Okay, and there's the second sheet for the handout. It's on a separate sheet because its color and the photocopier couldn't do it. So this kind, this situation that you have certain moves which you're permitted to do. Here the moves are swapping adjacent elements and you need to bring something into order is basically constituent for many puzzles. So for example, if you take the Rubik's Cube and I've taken a 2x2x2 cube simply because it's a little bit smaller and there we can actually still do things concretely and it's a little bit easier to write stuff down. The same thing would basically also hold for a 3x3x3 cube, but just there things become more complicated. What do I have there? I have my cube and I have 6 times 4, which is 24 small facelets, right? And what can I do with it? I can rotate things, and when I rotate them, I permute these facelets, right? And I can just do a certain number of permutations. I can't do immediately a permutation which would swap these two elements here, even not swap these two stones, because that's not what I can do. So I have a fixed set of generators with which I can work. And what is the problem which I have to solve, or which the puzzle setup asks me to solve? It says, if it is mixed up, bring it back into the original position, right? That's what it wants me to do. So, what I need to do is I need to take the, I need to see what permutations of the faces would I have to do to bring the cube back in its original position, right? That's what the puzzle, that's when I can do this, I have, if I can perform that permutation, I can, I have solved the puzzle, and how can I try to perform it? By doing the allowed moves, which are just certain fixed permutations. So I need to take this permutation which solves the puzzle and write it as a product of particular generating permutations. Okay. And that's a particular prominent example, but you can, there are other puzzles, for example, on the homework in problem 69. I have another example of a puzzle, which one can, where one can basically use the same approach for solving. Okay. So, to see how these faces get permuted, it is convenient to give them numbers. And that's just so I know which red, right? This red face is a different red face than this one, because this one here is together with white and blue, and this one is together with blue and yellow on there. So I need to distinguish them. And so I give them all numbers, and that's basically what I've prepared here. I've taken a cube and I've just written numbers on, and I've written them on the same scheme as on here, the folded out map of the cube is. Okay. Right. There is one further complication in there. And this complication is basically, that I can, could do certain moves with a cube, which really don't amount to messing up or solving the puzzle. So, for example, if I would turn this slice by 90 degrees, and then I turn this slice also by 90 degrees, but in opposite directions. What I have done is I've just taken the whole cube and rotated it in space, right? Okay, that does not really amount to mixing up the cube. I mean, if I say I mix it up, look here, a yellow is on top, can you turn it back with a white on the top? Probably everyone can do this. That's not a very hard puzzle. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to ignore these rotations of the whole cube in space. And the way I'm going to do this is the following. I say I take one corner. So I take what if I place the, okay, let's place the cube so as I want to have it here with the red on the front and white on the top. I take the bottom right corner. That is this corner here that has an orange 19, this has a blue 16 and a yellow 24. And I say, after, regardless how I mix up the cube, in the end, I want to take that corner and have it in the bottom right back place, in this orientation. Okay. So, by doing this, clearly I have killed all ways of rotating the cube in space, right? Because any rotation would either at least turn this thing or even move it around. On the other hand, if you have the cube mixed up, you can certainly just take it and easily place it back into this position. Right? Just by rotating it in space, moving this one stone back in this position. Okay. So, by doing this, I'm killing the space rotations of the cube, but the other thing which is happening now is that I'm saying, okay, I now can't, am not anymore allowed to do this slice rotation, right? But I don't really need this slice rotation. I can do it instead of rotating this slice and rotating it then back in space. This has the same effect as rotating this slice here, right? So, with this convention of fixing the back, bottom, right QB, I only need to do a rotation of the right slice, of the top slice, and of the front slice. Right? And that is not really taking away from the fun or mess of solving or mixing up the puzzle. It's the same problem. It's just I've removed the obstacle, the extra task of rotations in space, which really do not amount to a harder puzzle. If you have a 3x3x3 cube, typically the convention is there it's not enough to fix a corner, or you could also fix a corner, but there, for symmetry reasons, the convention is typically that you keep the middle, right? If you have, there you have three slices, so that you keep the middle points of all six faces in place. So there you are permitted to turn the right slice and left slice, and top slice and bottom slice and so forth, but you're not permitted to do the middle slices, which again would just have the effect of rotating the thing in space. Okay, so that's what I'm doing there. So now, and probably since I have this on, let me see whether I can actually do this without making a... So what I now need to do is I need to describe... Oh, this is fancy. Right. So I now need to, I take this cube, okay, let's see. I place it, this is the top, and it's placed towards me as I would in this fixed orientation placement. Okay, now I need to say what happens actually with the faces if I do a rotation. And I will assume for the rotations I can rotate both ways, but I will assume that the rotations I take are clockwise rotations when I look on the face. And if I want a counterclockwise rotation, that just would be the inverse of the permutation, right? I don't just have the elements, I also have their inverses, so I can do this. And I don't need to make two different generators there. So if I rotate this, if I take this top slice, and I rotate it clockwise when looking on the face. Okay, what is happening there? Right. So now I write down the permutation which this has done. One has gone where two was before. Two has gone to four was before. 4 has gone to 3 was before, and 3 has gone where 1 was before. But that's not all what is happening, right? Because I also have this ring around here, which also got permuted, right? When I did this top rotation. So, for example, this is now the front. I have a 14 here. The 14 is where before a 10 was. So this is a permutation which needs to map 14 to 10. Or if I look at what was the left side before, the 10 has gone where the 6 was before, and so forth, right? So from this, I can write down permutations for each three rotations, right? And if you look at the permutations which we get there, you see, this permutation actually has 1, 2, 3, 4 cycles. The first 4 cycle are the faces on the top. The next 4 cycle are the faces which are faces in this ring which are on the left side of each face. And the other cycle are the faces which are on the right side of each face. Right? And I have 8 faces around here, which split into 2 4 cycles by doing this rotation. And I can do the same thing with, the front rotation and with the side rotation, and I correspondingly also get 2 further permutations there. So I now have 3 permutations And they describe everything, what I, as far as puzzle goes, I mean, not throwing it through space or so, but everything as far as the puzzle goes, what I can do with this puzzle. Okay. And I can create the group from it, and I can ask, for example, the computer, how big is this group? And if I do this, it tells me it has order 3,674,160. So what I know, for example, okay, we don't know how it does it yet, but this, for example, tells me that this puzzle has 3 million and something possible mixed up positions. If you do the same thing for the 3 by 3 by 3 cube, you get the, what is it, 43 trillion or so, which they advertise on the box, which this puzzle has. Okay. And next time then we go about actually using this to solve it. Thank you very much. Oh, this shouldn't have gone in here. Yeah. You, yeah, sure.